You're listening to World Class from the Freeman Spogli Institute for International Studies at Stanford University. In this podcast series, we bring international affairs expertise from Stanford's campus straight to you. In 2007, the small Eastern European country of Estonia earned the dubious honor of being the first nation to suffer a state-sponsored cyber attack. It was carried out by Russia after the Estonian government moved a Soviet-era statue, and it changed how we think about warfare, security, and international relations. 10 years later, former Estonian President Toomas Ilves is the inaugural Bernard and Susan Liatode Distinguished Visiting Fellow at FSI. In this episode, he speaks with FSI Director Michael McFaul about the promises and perils of liberal democracy in the digital era.
President Ilves has been with us now for about 3 months or so. He is the inaugural Bernard and Susan Liatode Visiting Scholar here at CSAC and with various affiliations throughout FSI. This fellowship, by the way, Visiting Fellow, was designed specifically to bring people to Stanford right after they had finished a time in government. But there was another condition, that they had something intellectually to contribute to Stanford University. I think we landed on the perfect first Liatode Fellow. It would be a very hard act to follow. But do send your nominations in, because we'll be bringing somebody next year as well. President Ilves has had a long, interesting career, kind of the career I'd like to have, frankly.
I read today you're going to go work for pro bono for the Senate.
Correct. I volunteered for the Senate Intelligence Committee. They seem to be having trouble with staffers, so I'd love to intern for free. We'll work for food, as people say. He was the president of Estonia for 10 years, served 2 terms. Prior to that, he had virtually every job one could have in the Estonian government, right? Except the prime minister. Okay, that's a pretty interesting job you didn't have. Your career's not over. But he was here as ambassador. He served as foreign minister. And as we're going to talk about today, both as a practitioner and now as a thought leader, is at the intersection of technology, democracy, and security, both when he served as president and now thinking about these issues in broad terms. So we're going to have a bit of a conversation, although it's going to be brief. From my part, we have a ton of expertise in the room, just looking around. So I'm going to start with a few questions, unless you want to start with something. Do you want to start with something?
Well, I'd like to just start. Can you hear me? Okay. I'd like to start by thanking Donald Trump, because Donald Trump brought the three strands of my life together. Since as a child of refugees who had fled from the Soviet Union, I was always, from grade 8, I started reading the New York Times about Russia or the Soviet Union, and later on that grew into an interest into democracy more broadly when I was a teenager. And in between, I had this amazing serendipitous event in which I had a math teacher who once, for one semester only, taught a group of ninth graders to program, which meant that for my whole life I've been doing this more or less one way or another. So with the election of 2006, we see democracy, which is the main thing I'm going to talk about, being under threat, thanks to new digital technologies that haven't for at least the past 300 years of kind of electoral liberal democratic, electoral democracy, liberal democracy have not been employed. And then finally, of course, the fact that at least up till now, Russia has been the country most involved in getting at democracy. Though I would argue that there's no reason why other authoritarian governments cannot use exactly the same techniques that we saw last year here, and as we, if you follow the European news, is being done constantly in Europe. Just today there was another piece that the same hacking group, APT28, also known as Fancy Bear, Sophocy, and Paw and all things, Pawnstorm, had managed to hack both the two leading German political think tanks, the von der Adenauer Stiftung and the Friedrich Ebert Stiftung, having already 2 years ago hacked into the entire German parliament. And similarly, that the same group has actually been now doing setting up sites for spear phishing attacks on Macron team, though that had already been going on, but now this has been verified. So we're in this. I think we're in the beginning of a new phase in democracy, because we have these technologies that did not exist before, that are being used to undermine the way we do electoral democracy. And the responses to it, there have not been too many good responses to it, but at least one worrisome tendency is that we may affect some of the other parts of liberal democracy, that if we get the electoral part, sort of, we want to fix the electoral part with things such as, fake news and sort of Twitter bots, that we may end up impinging on some other aspects of liberal democracy, such as freedom of expression. And certainly you see movement in that direction with March 15th, the Justice Minister of Germany proposed some pretty draconian legislation on social media that does not immediately take down what is considered fake news. So, I think all I can do is just sort of chart the landscape for you. The answers, I think, will take a long time to figure out, but it is different from every election before, I'd say, 2016, the situation we're in. You could see it before coming here and there, but then you had to be paranoid. Now, sometimes the paranoids, in these cases, the paranoids, in fact, are right. And I think we will have to really address this in the future in all liberal democracies. And in fact, the only positive thing I can see is that maybe this might be, given the asymmetry of these attacks, they can do to liberal democracies, or authoritarian regimes can do to liberal democracies, but liberal democracies can't do back to them, because, they count the votes, so it doesn't really make any difference. And that may, in fact, lead liberal democracies to cooperate a little more against these threats. So, that's like my abstract.
Yeah, I want to get to the typology, and I want to get to the prescriptions. We have till 1:30, so we can solve this problem by 1:30, okay? But before we do so, I want to go back a little bit in history. I think when the definitive work on cybersecurity issues has been written, I hope it's being written right now at CSAC, it'll start with 2007. It'll start with you being attacked. You actually know the history, so inform us all about, maybe there were other attacks that I don't know about, but most certainly that was a definitive moment in my understanding of these issues and thinking about these issues. And I want to hear what it was like. Tell us what happened, how you responded, and what you did prescriptively moving forward as a country to prevent future attacks from Russia, and how worried should Estonians still be of those kinds of attacks in the future.
Okay, for those of you who don't know, in 2007, April, May, after the Estonian government decided to move a Soviet statue that was causing all kinds of problems, we experienced something called a DDoS attack. It was a massive DDoS. A DDoS attack is a distributed denial of service attack in which you overload servers so they can no longer respond. That was nothing new. DDoS attacks have taken place for several years already. It was a means of extortion, because you would a small or medium-sized business that did its business on the web would then be attacked, and its server wouldn't work, so they wouldn't get any business, and then they were extorted, kind of $10,000, $20,000 that you had to pay someone. someone. The way these things work, just also it's important to know that to get a better handle on, is that it's done by the same criminals who do spam. So when you get spam, you have these networks of bots or robots, robot computers, which are basically your and mine and everyone else's computer if you've downloaded malware, and then it's secretly under the control of some other people, and they would send out Viagra ads. Or whatever, you know, the spam stuff. And then you can reverse the operation. Instead of sending it all that shotgun style in all directions, you can send them towards selected servers. It's the same mechanism, it's the same people. Now, what happened in 2007, I said, was not new. It had been done before, but this was the first sort of Clausewitzian event in which it was no longer a criminal action to gain money, but rather it was a political act. So this was, and why Estonia stands out is, on the one hand, the fact that this was all-encompassing. It hit government servers, it hit all of the newspapers, it hit the banks, so effectively the country was kind of shut down, or at least the critical aspects of our sort of functioning. Was
that scary? Did it feel like, oh my God, the Russians are here?
No, we didn't know it was the Russians. I mean, okay. We had no idea. First of all, I discovered it, I found that, okay, this site doesn't work, that site doesn't work. I called up our sysadmin, I said, my computer, or do we have a problem? And he called back and said, everybody's got a problem. And so that was how we figured out that this was something big. It still took a little bit of time to figure out that it was not that a cable had been severed or something, and And pretty quickly, the CERT, or the Computer Emergency Response Team, said we are under a DDoS attack. And
so, just to interrupt you, because I'm really interested in the details. Who did you call? Was it your IT guy?
Well, the first guy calls me IT guy.
All right, all right. Just like the rest of us, the president is calling his IT guy.
He answers more quickly, or you get a quicker response than you do from the Stanford.
Well, you're not the president.
Well, yes, my wife says I'm not the president. Well, in any case, I should point out my wife was the national director for cybersecurity for our neighbor Latvia.
So I know there is a priority. The big first.
So how long did it take you to figure out that it was a Russian?
Correlation is not causality, but there seemed to be a strong correlation between Russian rhetoric and what we saw. The forensics on figuring who's done something is fairly difficult. The expert on forensics for cyber attacks is here, Herb Lynn. I highly recommend his wonderful article in the winter issue of the, whatever it is, Journal of International Affairs. Right. Very, very good article, because everyone always asks, well, how do you know? And you see this even to this day. We don't know it's the Russians. We don't know it's the Koreans. Well, actually, you have a pretty good idea if you put all the evidence together, but no one's going to come out in a court of law on this. Anyway, so that happened, and the interesting thing, which also gives you an insight into the way the Russians work, or other people can do it too, is that when it was all over, I went to the CERT to give a presentation on how they saw it, and what we saw on May 9th, which was then the anniversary of the Soviet-Russian anniversary of the end of World War II, you could see this sort of medium level of threat, and suddenly it spiked, and it went straight up, and then it continued, and then it dropped off. And I said, well, why is that not a normal Gaussian curve, with a normal distribution bell curve? And they said, well, because the money ran out. I said, what? And well, it turns out that this is how we figured out, or I figured out, how this system worked, is basically you pay these criminal gangs, are organized crime gangs that do this illegal activity, and so the attack started the peak attack started at 0000 GMT and ended at 24000 GMT. So I mean, it was, you just pay by the hour or you pay by the day. And then, of course, this leads to which led to my next conclusion that that given this organized crime is paid for by the Russian government or some subset of it, that this gives a unique is a unique form of public-private partnership, and that in Russia you don't have ISPs, internet service providers, you have CSPs, criminal service providers.
So what was the response? What did you do to defend yourselves after that?
Okay, well, first of all, there are a number of things that fell out of that. One, for one, since we had been already for 3 years, because in general Estonia is very developed in IT, and may have been one of the reasons why I think we were attacked, because they thought, okay, we can sort of do something to the reputation of this country that already then was known as kind of a digital pioneer. But we have been complaining or urging NATO for 3 years to deal with cyber issues, and they kept saying, that's not really important. And then when this happened, in fairly short order, NATO decided we will put a center of cyber security, well, a center of excellence, actually, it's an academic institution, in Tallinn. We've been asking for that. So that was one part of the fallout. Another thing that happened, which I have to commend now your colleague here, I mean, within... when the attack started, like the next day, Condi Rice called me up and said, you know, we're here, we're to help, can we do anything? And by the way, the next day the president, and tomorrow the president will call you. So then President George Bush called me up. Again, I think it was the optics that was really important, because he just said, I want you to come over to Washington. You know, it was basically in 4 weeks. Go ahead and tell people that you've been invited by me, which again raised the profile. And that's, you know yourself as a diplomat, that the optics often actually does even more than what the reality of the situation is. But I mean, it was the thing that focused NATO's attention much more on cyber issues and...
But no discussion of Article 5.
No,
right?
No.
Just to be clear?
No. This is an unresolved issue to this day, whether it counts. Different countries within NATO have different approaches. The United States already said 4 years ago that it need not answer to a cyber attack in the same domain, meaning if cyber is a domain of warfare along with land, air, sea, and space, if you attack the United States in cyber, the United States will attack you maybe some other way. In response, the whole issue of what is a proportional response to a cyber attack has yet to be resolved, and that is one of the big conundrums that we face. That okay, I mean, if you take out an electrical power plant with a missile, which you see on the radar, the missile comes and it hits it, and then you know where it came from, and you probably know who did it, and you know that well, proportional would be to take out a similar thing. Whereas in a cyber attack, even though, as I said before, the forensics will ultimately allow you to determine who did it, it can take a while, because then you have to marshal all the resources, both SIGINT and human intelligence, to figure out where it came from. And then what do you do in response to that is another thing. And so... this does upset kind of the sort of standard view of things like deterrence and so forth.
Right.
There are two entire books which have been produced now by the NATO Center in Tallinn on the application of international law on warfare and also on sort of non-warfare, but two cyber attacks. And it is a huge area of contention, and there are protocols and conventions that can be applied, and there are others that can't be. And one of the big problems is that in this area we don't have any kind of legal, international legal framework that could be, that would apply to the people that would do these things.
Right.
We have one thing, which was originally called the Council of Europe Convention on Cybercrime, because it was the Council of Europe, but Strasbourg came up with it. It was rapidly acceded to by Japan, the United States, Mexico, Canada, all these countries that are not in the Council of Europe for obvious reasons. But it is a convention that obligates then those who have acceded to it to extradite people someone is a cyber criminal and has committed a crime, say from Estonian territory against the United States, we would then hand that person, and the U.S. would say this guy did it, we'd go arrest them, and then we'd extradite him to the United States, and this has actually happened a number of times. I mean, most recently with a Russian hacker in Canada, but we've extradited people, Latvia has extradited people, and they're often surprised because the U.S. Sentences are rather draconian versus what European ones. But the problem is that people who actually most of the time do this live in countries that have not acceded to this convention. The convention is now called the Budapest Convention, as I think I said, because it now is worldwide, but unfortunately it does not have Russia, Belarus, maybe Ukraine has acceded to it since 2014, but before that it was another major source of both cybercrime and cyberattack, and of course the People's Republic of China. All of those countries remain outside that framework, yet being the main primary sources of these kinds of at least criminal acts, the legal framework doesn't help us much.
So all these questions are a prelude to talking about 2016, because there's a case study, and I want people to understand the case study before we get to our elections. What did you do to protect your systems, your computers, after this attack? And what could you do legally? Were there issues? I mean, kind of getting back to the things you alluded to, in terms of enhancing cybersecurity for Estonia.
Well, first of all, let me explain one thing, because everyone's Estonians were the first to be hacked. No, a DDoS attack does not get into anything.
Right.
So that means
it just
stops you from accessing your whatever it is you want, your bank, your newspaper, the government site. Well. We did set up some cooperation with a number of countries, and we already had a little bit, but it wasn't advanced enough because we had prepared just before this incident for a potential DDoS attack, because we had our first electronic voting, digital.
I wanted to ask you about that. So
and so one of the scenarios we thought of was that someone might attack actually that server. And so we set up some cooperation with the Czechs and the Slovenes and a couple of other countries that we could mirror these. So that mirror meaning that you could still access the site even though the server in question is under attack.
Okay.
But we did that in a much bigger way after the attack and set up much stronger cooperation, which managed to pay off for Georgia a year later, when the same, a more advanced form of the same kind of cyber attack took place, because there it became hybrid. Because what happened in Georgia, and you can read about this in two successive issues of the Small Wars Journal from about 2011, I think, they would blank out an area with the DDoS attacks and then bomb it. So you would increase the kind of Clausewitzian fog of war, because not only you would not know what's happening, you couldn't access anything to find out what's happening, and then you would be bombed or shelled, I don't know which one it was. And by that time, what we were doing, as soon as the Georgians saw that this was happening to their sites, we then started mirroring the Georgian sites to get over this. DDoS attacks, I would just say that back then were done by bots of computers that had been taken over by criminal gangs and people who downloaded bad material. Basically, porn sites are the main source of that kind of malware. It has gotten much worse since then, in a big leap, that thanks to the development of the Internet of Things. And all these closed-circuit television cameras, refrigerators, you know, your Amazon Echo or whoever does that, all of those things are so-called IoT devices. They're machines talking to machines. The problem with these machines, at least as they are, these devices, when they're set out, is that they have their passwords are usually things like 12345 or 000. They're not well protected. And last October, we saw a massive increase in the level of DDoS attacks when with something called the Mirai attack, in which someone, first of all, some group, managed to get a huge number of IoT devices, they're basically, they really are robots. They're not even it's not downloaded malware, they were just hijacked. We're first of all increasing the number of attackers dramatically, but moreover, fixed on a genuine node, the company DYN, which is a DNS company, does the basically the DNS, the sort of the domain name server, is the one of those nodes where when you type in stanford.edu, that company changes the number into the 12-digit code that actually is your domain. And so what happened was that there is this company in New York, employs about 500 people. It's called DYN. You could look it up. It's Mirai, M-I-R-I-A-I, was the attack. And basically, by attacking this little node, it's a company that simply changes names into numbers to direct your internet traffic, that went down, and large parts of the United States and Europe were without coverage thanks to that node being attacked. And here again, this is a step beyond first, because you have far more attackers, because every little machine that hasn't been properly passworded can be hacked, and moreover, they looked at a key node that would take out a huge swath, as opposed to, say, focusing on, you know, my bank in Estonia, which is kind of only affects me and a couple other people.
Well, that gets. I'm only on my second question, by the way, so I'm only going to go to my third one, and then I'll open it up. But still, back on to Estonia before we get to 2016 here, and your typology of different instruments of interference. You know, there's the dual sides of technology, which I've heard you talk about before, and we're not spending much time today talking about the virtues of technology and the amazing things that you have done and your country has done. But the edge, I think, for, you know, just listening to you talk, is about voting. And tell us a little bit about what you think are the virtues of the way that Estonians vote, and tell people why they shouldn't be concerned that Estonian voters might have a greater risk of having their votes somehow manipulated because of what you've done.
Well, it's a whole lecture, but
I know.
Basically,
pretend you're on Twitter.
It's digital voting. It is not going to an electronic machine and pushing a button. It is based on, first of all, the very strong identification system we have, which is a chip card, which allows you to do two-factor authentication, and also the back and architecture, which allows you only to get to you, that is, to your data, your little cell. And so the two things are that normally people are afraid about is that one is you can't sort of hack a password and get in. You can only do it through a very high level of security identification. And secondly, once you get in,
higher than at Stanford, right? You told me, much higher. Let's not talk about Stanford. Like, keep going.
No, it's just the system that Stanford uses is we in Estonia call, we don't call two-factor authentication, we call it 1.5-factor authentication.
Okay.
Thank you. Because you get it over your, completely hackable cell phone. I mean, so it's not really, it's like, it is an additional factor, but it doesn't really give you that much. If someone really wants to get you, they can, in fact, eavesdrop on your cell phone. So it's not that secure.
Okay. There are people that really want to get me, so you're not making me feel better. Keep going.
I should just add that Stanford shouldn't feel bad, because I read 2 days ago that the U.S. Congress has ID cards with a chip, except it's not really a chip. It's a sticker that looks like a chip. I'm not kidding. So it looks like they're really up to date and modern, but they don't have two-factor authentication of the type that U.S. government offices now have, but it's really, you look hip and cool. So anyway, so you get on, you vote. So if you were, I mean, in order to sort of really do the election, you have to get everybody individually, which is rather hard, especially with two-factor authentication. Right now, for the past four elections, about 33% of the electorate votes online. Why do people do it? Well, I mean, first of all, you manage to get people who are abroad. I mean, Catherine is lucky to come from such a big country that they actually have France as a polling station. But I mean, if you're Estonian, it's not so easy. Or I even know that one of the former CEO of Skype told me about how he was sitting with his Finnish friend, and Finnish and Estonian elections are always within a week of each other, and so. Well, I guess I'll vote. And the other guy said, you voted. And the other guy said, I have to drive down to L.A. if I want to vote. I won't bother. Anyway, so that's how it works. I mean, you vote. And with the way it works also to avoid some of the problems is that people can conjure up is that you can change your vote. Because they said, well, what? Because as opposed to a polling place. What happens if you're voting home and someone comes with a gun and says, you will now vote for that person? Well, you can later go change your vote. And also, even if that happens at the last minute, you can always go to the polling station and that voids your earlier vote. The interesting thing about we have a sociology of a sort of IT behavior, sociologist of IT behavior. So he studied these now for six elections. Initially, people thought that they would be urban, younger, and more sort of left. Well, left, liberal would be the right word. But after three elections, it all evened out. So basically, left, right, urban, rural, young, old, there really are. It's a flat curve and has been for three elections, which I think comes from the basic penetration of IT in society in this general use, so that it mirrors the society pretty well. When it comes to elections. I mean, it's one of many things that we offer in Estonia, which is part of my bigger spiel, saying that if you want to develop a digital society, you have to focus not on the things that most governments want, which is the Ministry of Finance saying we can tax you better, but rather on services that people like. So voting, we have digital signatures, which you can do all kinds of legal documents, which is a big thing. Digital prescriptions, so that you don't have to go see your doctor, at least for refills. But even if you go see a doctor, he puts it in the computer, and then you can go to any pharmacy to get it. And most importantly, I would say it's a huge step, even though it's not getting much press, but. In the first time ever that there is any kind of interoperability in digital services between countries is that Estonia and Finland are going to have a mutually interoperable digital prescription, so that you get 8 million Finns coming a year, and they're always having a good time in Thailand because it's much more interesting, and they're always using...
No, the booze is cheaper.
That is much more interesting.
He's humble. That was actually his initiative, not the booze bit, but they took
it. Well, it was a long initiative. The problem is this is something that was technologically was possible 30 years ago, but it's, what I proposed 5 years ago, it's only now that it's coming in.
It's true.
But at least that's, I mean, ultimately I would see all of Europe working this way.
Right.
I mean, that would be how the European Union should function, that public services such as prescriptions, legal signature, all these things are mutually interoperable across borders. Unfortunately, right now, Europe is the opposite, which is that physical goods, people, capital, services, I mean, physical services can move across borders, but digital services with huge difficulty, and that's what, now with this little promo for Estonia, I mean, our presidency is starting on July 1, and our whole thing is promoting the digital single market agenda, but that's...
Well, so let me ask one last question, and then I'll open it up to anything, by the way. This is a Ask Me Anything kind of Reddit session. I'm going to skip my questions about populism in Europe. Maybe we'll talk about those tomorrow. And ask you instead about America and our elections. You arrived here right at the time that all of these issues became very germane for most Americans who hadn't thought about them. Correlation is not causation. I think you said that earlier today. But
causation is not correlation.
Yeah. or the other. But tell, just, you know, riff a little bit on what you've observed, what you think is going on. Tell us your best guess of what the Russians have done, what they intended to do. And then if we have time, you know, maybe a little bit about prescriptions. But, you know, just your general impressions.
Well, first of all, I think there are so many misconceptions about what is going on that, I mean, at least I try, in the paper, just to sort of do a typology of what's going on.
Yeah.
Let's just start. I mean, so the term hacking an election is a useful metaphor, but it is not, it does not describe anything. I mean, there are numerous mechanisms, some of which I don't think anyone even understands quite yet, at least I try and don't. But first of all, I mean, hacking is the most basic thing of going into a computer. And this is what happened to the Democratic National Committee. We hear from the FBI director that they also went into the RNC, or the Republican National Committee. The difference between the two gives rise to the next mechanism, which is doxing, which is a term that came from the WikiLeaks, 7-8 years ago, in which you publish documents. And this is where there is a difference between what happened to the Democrats and the Republicans, was that if Lisa Comey said they went into both servers, both groups' servers, they only published and stole, I mean, stole and published the material from the Democratic server. And so, I mean, that was, did a huge amount of damage to the Clinton campaign. Already hacking into a computer like that is not something one should do. I say basically it is equivalent to the 1972 June break-in of again, the Democratic National Committee in the Watergate Hotel. The difference is that that was physical. The people were caught, and which ultimately led to the resignation of the president. But the thing that amazes, what is different today, is the sociology or psychology of the media, which, I mean, if you steal the physical correspondence of a political party, or as was attempted to do in 1972, that would, there would have been universal condemnation, and really people would not have looked at what is in that. The media response, and I think the New York Times even regrets it, to the theft of, I mean, their purloined letters. I mean, to use the sort of, you know, Edgar Allan Poe, I think, was it, right? I mean, they are stolen. And then they're published. And instead of going, wow, look at this, people have stolen the correspondence of a political party, and being aghast at that, they, with this vulgar voyeurism, instead focus on the content of that rather than the fact that, how did this happen? That, you know, and why are we even discussing this? And, you know, if that doesn't help, then think about having your own email act and then looking for something that could really be embarrassing to someone, and then having, and the effect was huge. I mean, the chairman resigned as a result of, you know, she had made some comments about Sanders. I mean, who of us has not said something nasty about someone else, a third person, in our in our emails, which are stored on the server that may be hacked into? So I mean, that's so. First, you have hacking, then you have doxing. I mean, you add to that fake news, which is again, I mean, in and of itself is nothing new. I mean, the Trojan horse was fake news. Because they said we went away, but they didn't go away, and we're leaving you this gift. But what is, but as a, the prominence of fake news, of lies, thanks to this new digital environment of Facebook and Twitter, the problem that we face, that it has completely changed our consumption of news, or they have. The Pew, is always doing these studies, found that last June that 62% of Americans, for 62% of Americans, the primary source of news is Facebook. So, I mean, it may be the New York Times, or it may be, you know, Breitbart, or whatever it is, but you're getting it all from, or at least 62% of Americans are getting it from primarily from Facebook. And on the other side, in addition to Facebook, there's Twitter, where you have these, we have Twitter bots that, you know, just constantly repeat certain items, so that two different followers or non-followers. And the big researcher on this, by the way, is a, I understand from you, is the star of the Stanford baseball team.
Basketball.
Kate Starbird is at the University of Washington, but is doing superb work, and I hope you invite her here sometime, on how fake news is spread. And she has a piece, a really good piece on Medium.com from about a month ago, on how she started researching this when she was looking at how news of man-made disasters spread. And she took as a case study the Boston Marathon bombing, and she studied what, you know, and she discovered that all these bizarre conspiracy theories arose immediately, rather, I mean, saying that Navy SEALs did it, you know, even when they'd arrested sort of two Chechens and so forth. But it spread massively across the Twitter sphere. And that's when she discovered that there are these politically motivated Twitter bots, or politically managed Twitter bots, that spread conspiracy theories or theories that things didn't happen. And so these things go viral. The most recent one she looked at was the Syria hashtag here, Syria hoax, which again went viral. Claiming that no sarin gas or sarin attack had occurred. And so this then becomes a trending topic on Twitter, and then people who are silly enough to look at what's trending will retweet it, and it just turns into an avalanche. So the third aspect is sort of social media. Through social media, the truth becomes devalued. There's a wonderful book which I would urge even for entertainment value to read, which is by a man named Peter Pomerantsev. It's called Nothing is True and Everything is Possible, about his experiences in Russia as a television producer, which is from about 10 years ago, but it applies today. And it, the central sort of MNL's glee there is Surkov. The sort of I don't know what you call him, not the Grey Cardinal, we call him the Wizard of Oz. And bizarrely enough, the new administration decided that he will be the interlocutor for future discussions with Russia. But anyway, how he runs the entire media of Russia, and how, you know, you're told don't do this. we saw the same thing happen. We saw sort of the real explosion of fake news with the Ukrainian invasion of Ukraine. Before that, there had been a lot of disinformation being spread about sort of within Russia, and then in Eastern Europe. But during the Georgian War, we saw a lot of that. But where it really took off was the Ukrainian invasion, when in fact the Western media was inundated with fake news, which were then naively enough in the beginning picked up by Western news sources, saying, "Well, we want to have a balanced picture. So you have a lie about the Ukrainians crucifying a little boy, and then the Ukrainians saying no, and then you have the BBC saying, well, we have to present both sides." They've calmed down a bit on that when they realize that there is such a thing as fake news. So, that's it. The all three that I mentioned are already new developments. Now, where it gets really scary to my mind, but I don't know quite the mechanism yet, is that big data and analytics has gone to the point where in the political process, you can basically dispense with mass communication. There is a company called Cambridge Analytica that does big data analytics, and based on whatever you feed into it, you can pinpoint very specifically, in a very granular way, your audience and tail your messages to them. And Cambridge Analytica is a company that was, first of all, his major investor is one of Trump's biggest supporters, Robert Mercer, along with his wife, and Steve Bannon is on the board of this company, and its CEO gives talks about how well one can, in fact, go and send target messages very simply. If I can find the quote somewhere here, because they say it outright. Now, the question we haven't really figured out is how much of this is self-promotion and how much of it is really true. But in any case, big data analytics can, in fact, target audiences in a way that you live on that block, you are this ethnicity, you seem to be of this income range. You have a message that goes. Here's the quote from Alexander Nix, who's the CEO. "A really ridiculous idea. The idea that all women should receive the same message because of their gender, or all African Americans because of their race." That is, what they sell is targeting very specific messages. The question is, you have to know who you have to target. And this, for me at least, raises a suspicion on one of the other rather unreported sides of Russia's efforts last year, which is that the voting rolls in a number of states, were stolen by the Russians, the same group, APT 28 or Fancy Bear, broke into certain state governments and stole the voting rolls. Now, why would you do that? Because you can't really affect the vote. You can't change their vote. But why would you want to know who's voting, if not for use in targeting specific voters? So, when you put all of this together, aside from being very depressing, is that that the way we do electoral democracy today, we do it the old way, but we have to understand that we are facing the kinds of threats to the process that we could not imagine, 10 years ago, or you could imagine, but you had to have a pretty wild imagination. And so how do we proceed? One of the things that worries me is that some of the responses, at least, could in turn undermine the democratic process or liberal democracy as we know it. Because when you see a country like Germany, which really takes a very hard line on all kind of extremism and especially right-wing extremism, having been subjected to fake news from Russia, and this year there was even a fake news story broadcast by Breitbart, which said that 1,000, completely false, claiming 1,000 Muslims on New Year's Eve had burned down Germany's oldest church. And when they see that, and they see the reactions of the German public and the sort of the rise of a hardcore right-wing party, Allianz für Deutschland, they go, we're not going to allow Nazis to come back. I mean, they're far more hardcore about this than anyone else. I guess they've been fairly well denazified compared to some other countries. So, I mean, it is anathema to them. And so the responses may not always be so sort of Anglo-Saxon liberal democratic as we might think, because in fact, as I said, the German Ministry of Justice has proposed a law that would levy up to $50 million fines, or basically $55 million for any fake news that is not removed immediately. which of course scares the hell out of companies like, Facebook and Twitter. But that's one possible response, at least to part of these scourges. What other things that you can do and should do is that when I mentioned two-factor authentication before, David Sanger in the New York Times said that of the 128 people with access to the servers of the DNC, 126 used two-factor authentication. Guess who they got? Those two that did not use two-factor authentication. Wow. Not that two-factor authentication is will give you ultimate safety, but it raises the threshold for breaking in substantially. It is something that everyone should use, but you should use a better system than what you have here.
Thanks for listening to World Class from the Freeman Spogli Institute for International Studies at Stanford University. Follow us on Twitter at FSI Stanford or visit our website at fsi.stanford.edu for more events and expertise from the world of international studies.